Krishna teases Rukmini. Text 52. Krishna speaking to Rukmini. Although I have the power to award spiritual liberation, lusty persons worship me with penance and vows in order to get my blessings for their mundane family life. Such persons are bewildered by my illusory energy. Purport. The word dampatye indicates the relationship between husband and wife. Lusty and bewildered persons worship the Supreme Lord to enhance this relationship, though they know he can free them from their useless attachment to temporary things. Om Jnana Timirandasya Jnanandana Shalakya Chakshun Muditam Yena Jai Sri Krishna Jai Kanya Prabhuddha Kama Sri Vinyakara Sri Vasari Gaur Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. This chapter is entitled Krishna Teases Rukmini. Why not? Why shouldn't the Supreme Personality of Godhead tease his wife? As Krishna himself explains, this is one of the pleasures of family life. And since Krishna in Dwarka is demonstrating the ideal of Grihastha, while at the same time showing he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, why should he not tease his wife? His wife happens to be his own internal potency. The queens in Dwarka can be traced back to expansions of the gopis of Goloka Vrindavan. Sometimes it is said that Rukmini is a direct expansion of Srimati Radharani. In detail, Jagannanda Pandit explains that actually that's a general statement in that they are both expansions of the internal potency. But in terms of correspondence in nature, the relationship is more between Srimati Radharani and Satyabhama, because they're both not so submissive, whereas Rukmini is very submissive. And we're seeing that in this chapter. Krishna has spoken words that would terrify the heart of any wife who was attached to her husband. Oh, get someone else. It's not too late for a divorce, even though we have children still. Okay, you can find someone else. I'm not qualified. Who knows my social status? I'm just a wanderer, irresponsible. It's not too late. Get someone else. These words were a shock in Vedic culture. Of course, in current so-called civilization, such words are not shocking at all. These things, first of all, most people don't even bother to marry. The social statistics reveal more children these days in first world countries are living in single parent homes than in homes with their original parents. It's so ridiculous that when I was in Canberra, doing a program at the home of one Indian gentleman, he told me how his daughter came home from school, and she's 8 years old, and she said to her mother and father, "Mother and father, when are you going to live in separate houses like everyone else in my class? Why are you still living under the same roof? It would be so much fun, you know, to spend one weekend at mother's house, the next weekend at father's house. All my friends do that. What's happening? What's wrong with this house? What's wrong with this family? Why aren't you living separately?" In other words, it's become the norm. Anything else is abnormal. So, if people do bother to marry, then in most cases, there is divorce. And not simply one divorce these days, but two divorces. The statistics show that the second marriage has a less chance to work than the first marriage. You can't satisfy your material desires. I was flying on the airplane from Delhi once, sitting next to a man. He's about 40, 46. And he was an American. He was the construction engineer in charge of the Delhi subway construction. And he was just flying back to the US because basically his job was done. So he was telling me, I divorced 2 years ago and I remarried. But I don't know about this one. I don't know. Remarried a year. It's just, I don't know. I don't think it's the one. I said, what are you doing? You're 46 years old. What are you looking for? I don't know, but it's just not working. So this is the standard these days, that you feel empowered to keep changing your external situation in hopes that you're going to get that happiness. You keep juggling your external situation, sifting through relationships, changing relationships like they're consumer goods, just like you change your mobile phone, and you change the relationship. This is the standard these days. The only honor, the only integrity is you should do what you have to do to gratify your senses. Everyone appreciates that's dharma. You have an allegiance to your senses. And it's totally appropriate that you become the slave of your own mind. Allegiance to your senses, slave to your own mind, that's dharma. Everything should be justified based on that criteria. How do your senses feel? If your senses feel good, it's a good decision. If your senses feel bad, you gotta do something in your life. Make some good changes. Because as a human being, in this temporary human form of life, you have a right to get as much material pleasure as you can. That's your mandate. Like they say, politicians have a mandate. They have a supposedly because the people elect them, the politicians have a responsibility to discharge to the people. So they take it very seriously. I've been given this mandate by the people. I guess if English is not your first language, that word may delude you. And everyone understands mandate. You've been empowered by the vote to take charge of the people and lead them a certain way. So the politicians say very proudly, I've got a mandate from the people to lower the taxes or raise the taxes or whatever. Then as an excuse for all the lies they tell during their campaign and all the tricks they do while campaigning for office and trying to get votes for the election, they generally say, look, in order to carry out the mandate of the people, first you have to get elected. So therefore, it's appropriate that you say whatever is necessary to get elected so that you can carry out your mandate to the people. Everything is cheating these days. And no one cares. Have you noticed how acceptable it is just to cheat? No one takes it so seriously. Whether you marry, whether you divorce, whatever. Be loyal to your sense gratification. That is dharma. If you have children and your family breaks apart, the rationale is, look, you have to be honest to your sense gratification. Your children will appreciate that better. Set the example. Be true to your sense gratification because that's what your children are going to do anyway. So you might as well show them reality. That's the job of the parent. I'm not happy, my dear son. Your mother and I just can't get along. We just want to look for other options. I'm being honest with you, so you should appreciate that honesty. That's the main thing. We're both doing what we have to do in order to be happy. And that's all we want for you. Just be happy any kind of way. That's the only advice in the Western world parents can give their children. I think it's so full of meaning, so full of significance. whatever makes you happy, dear. Your mother and father, whoever your, you know, whoever your mother's living with at the moment, or your father's living with at the moment, we just want to see that you're happy. And they say that like it's a maha mantra, a maha bhakya. We just want to see that you're happy. It's like the top to form of your guys. So many devotees in the Western world I talk to, that's what their parents tell them. That's the only thing their parents can tell them. So, Krishna teasing Rukmini. Here you have relationships on a completely different level. You're not dealing with the material energy. Krishna is showing his Naralila, his human-like pastimes, to attract your mind. And also there's some didactic or instructive purpose to these pastimes. He's showing you how to live as a proper householder with honor and with to be progressive. Of course, you can't imitate Krishna and have 16,108 wives. One of the symptoms of Kali Yuga, declared by Shukadeva Goswami, is that daksham katumba bhavanam. If a man can just maintain one wife and a couple of children, he's known as daksha, expert. Whereas in previous yugas, it's a big deal about one wife and a couple of kids. But now, those who can actually properly take care of a wife and a couple of kids, they are, it's considered quite extraordinary. Krishna, this 16,180 wives, he's showing you by how he treated each wife, how he led his home life, he's showing you how to be responsible. At the same time, he's also showing you he's the Supreme Personality of God. You can't imitate him. Everyone is Krishna's part and parcel. So why one wife? Why not 16,108? And as we always point out, if you want to criticize Krishna for being lusty, then you have to properly accuse him and say he's unlimitedly lusty. We can't conceive of what it's like to be unlimitedly lusty. Because material lust has its limitations. Men, biologically, they know that. They get all wired up and ready for the kill, so to speak. And then afterwards, they're just totally depleted. And then the material nature flares up in them again. And they get all wired up. Oh, this is so important. They get their predator instincts in play, their predator maneuvers, and then they score their goal, and then material lust has a limit, but at the same time, it cannot be satisfied, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, just brain on the lane child burns like fire and never satisfied. But there's a limit to its potency. That's my point. There's not a limit to the desire. You see how material nature tricks you. There's not a limit to the desire, but there's the limit. There's a limit to the potency or strength for executing the desire. You're smart enough to figure this out. You save yourself so much trouble. As they say in common talk, it's a rip-off. That's the job of material nature. You got this. You got this desire that just goes on and on and on. It's a limited desire, because you're just a limited entity. But you don't have the potency to fulfill that limited desire. If you can understand this, you save yourself so much trouble. It's a trick. Whereas Krishna has unlimited desires, plus the unlimited ability to satisfy his unlimited desires. That's the higher definition of the absolute truth than simply he creates, he maintains, he destroys. I often point out, I remember going to Sunday school as a little boy at church, and they would teach us a song to impart to us knowledge of Divya Gyan, knowledge of the supreme absolute truth. Who made the mountains? Who made the sea? somebody bigger than you love me.
Okay.
And then, before we would eat meals, Mother said, you must say your grace, you must say your prayers. I mean, carry our vigils out. We would do, what is it? God is great, God is good, and we thank him for our food. By his hand we all are fed. Give us, Lord, our daily bread.
You did that one too?
Yeah.
Anyone else did that one?
We appreciate it even more.
Oh yes, so when it came, I've said, when it came to holiday banquets, holiday family gatherings, the family used to invite the minister, the pastor over, and he would bless the big turkey banquet. And he would often give these long-winded prayers. Father in heaven, we ask thy blessings upon this family, and he would go from house to house doing blessings in the middle of an envelope, you know. It goes on in other religions also.
<Good pick.
laughs> Yeah, he'd make a long-winded prayer, and then he would, as he's leaving the house, you know, the older man would, you know, slip him an envelope and put it in his little pack inside his suit jacket. So anyway. Finally, my father got tired of all these long-winded ministers coming giving prayers. So he said, look, here's the deal. We all want to eat. So he had a special. He said, we'll stop inviting the minister, and here is the prayer. Good Lord, good meat, good gravy, let's eat. So that there is some conception of God. He's giving the eatables, although you're eating the wrong thing. He's providing, he's maintaining, he's created the mountains, the seas. This is very primitive God realization, but it's better than nothing. So we don't criticize religions. We appreciate how anyone is trying to have some understanding of God. At the same time, we recognize there are different levels. You don't criticize a child for first grade knowledge. Child says one, if your 5-year-old kid says 1 + 1 = 2, you stupid idiot. You know, you appreciate it. Very good, very good. You have to start somewhere. Well, similarly, if someone says God is great, God is good, he's created, he's maintained, well, very nice. We appreciate it. At the same time, we're aware that there are much higher levels. So the definition of the Supreme Absolute Truth given in Chaitanya Charitamrita is much, much higher. Mm. Swaraja Lakshmi, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami says, Krishna has unlimited desires, and he is independent in fulfilling his unlimited desires. He doesn't rely on anyone or anything for fulfilling unlimited desires. Now, as we often point out, just think, whenever you desire, consider all that you have to go through to fulfill that desire. You should make a desire chart sometimes. It's like engineers make flow charts, or administrators, managers make organizational charts. Make a chart of your desires and see all that you have to go through to fulfill a desire. You'll be shocked. Money's required, a house is required. You get money in a house, you're still not satisfied, you have to impress the relatives. On it goes. And then what is your social status? How are people appreciating you? Then how secure is your arrangement? Are you protected against every possible thing that can happen in the material world? It just never ends. So we are very tiny in our desire capacity, and we're very tiny in our ability to fulfill our desires. But not Krishna. He has the unlimited ability, Swaraja Lakshmi, and the independent ability to fulfill all his desires. And part of that program is his speaking and teasing Rukmini. She's his internal potency. And she's very submissive, as you know. So submissive that Krishna wanted to provoke her just to see her beauty in anger. How many of you householder men would take that risk? That's why I was doing it. And then afterwards, you would say, I just wanted to see your face and your beautiful anger expression on your face. Really. You have to risk the hell and brimstone and fire that would break out. It's too risky. Too much of a drama. But Krishna's a supreme enjoyer, and he's thinking, I want to see the complete beauty of my beloved, which is his internal potency. So he provoked her. He told her, get another husband. Now, for a woman, a married woman, especially a married woman with children, this is horrible. But Krishna, the supreme enjoyer, he can play like that. And after his wife, his chief wife, Rukmini, collapsed on the ground, as the Shastra says, knocked down by a high wind. You have banana trees here in Queensland, and you have the storms here. So the example Srila Prabhupada gives in Krishna book is like a banana tree knocked down by a high wind. She just went down like that. She could not conceive that Krishna could be saying such things. She couldn't understand why. So immediately she lost so much weight, her golden bangles fell off of her arms because there was not enough weight to hold them up. She collapsed on the ground, her hair scattered. At that moment, Krishna manifests four hands. With two hands, he picked her up off the floor, and with the other two hands, he smoothed her hair. This is romance. Who can you get that from except Krishna? And Rukmini, she later told Krishna that. In response to Krishna's words, she said, "What? A woman has to be foolish to accept an ordinary man who's a bag of flesh decorated with mustache and beard and hair instead of you." So Krishna is showing he's the master of personal relationships. He has the ability, the potency. He can manifest unlimited hands, what to speak of four hands. But in Dwarka Leela, he mostly acts like he has his two-handed form. And especially in Vrindavan, Krishna has his two-handed form because it creates, there's more sweetness in that way. When he doesn't show his power and might. But in this case, with Rukmini down on the floor collapsed, he showed four hands and he picked her up with two and smoothed her hair with the other two. And then he began to explain, you know, it's just part of household life that a man works hard during the day. When he comes home in the evening, he wants to have some joking words with the wife. So that was all, you know. That's why I said, you know, you can divorce me and get another man. Just stirring the rasa, that's all. And Rukmini took it all in such a submissive way. So Krishna replied to her, as you heard during class yesterday, "O sinless one, I have now seen firsthand the pure love and chaste attachment you have for your husband. Even though shaken by my words, your mind could not be pulled away from me." And in the purport, Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur quotes a verse describing the quality and integrity of pure love. When the affectionate bond between a young man and a young woman can never be destroyed, even when there is cause for the destruction of that relationship, the attachment between them is said to be pure love. This is the nature of the eternal loving affairs between Lord Krishna and his pure conjugal associates. Now just think how that would apply to relationships you know in this world. Even when there is every cause, not a cause, but every cause for the destruction of that relationship, the affectionate bond can never be destroyed. That attachment is said to be pure love. This is unconditional love. How can you have unconditional love in a world of conditions between conditioned souls? Conditioned life means selfishness. I have to do what I have to do in order to improve my conditions. Whereas pure love for Krishna has nothing to do with improving material conditions. Therefore, we hear in the verse today, Krishna speaking, although I have the power to award spiritual liberation, lusty persons worship me with penance and vows in order to get my blessings for their mundane family life. Such persons are bewildered by my illusory energy. On the one hand, even if you have material desires, it is appropriate to approach the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as Shukadeva Goswami explains in the second canto, Akama Sagatama Va Moksha Kandra Dharati. Whether you are free from all material desires, Akama. Moksha Kama, whether you are hankering for liberation, freedom from material existence, or sarvakama, you're full of material desires. Never mind, tivrena bhakti yogena, engage in devotional service with the focus of a sunbeam, a ray of sunlight, engage in devotional service. On the other hand, still we have to point out, it's unintelligent to worship Krishna from material desires. Why ask Krishna for something that will cause you to remain embedded in material life? If you're a devotee who is sincere about being progressive in your bhakti, then Krishna, he acts proactively with you. He fulfills your material desires, as he says, in such a way that you'll never ask him for those things again. He, like an expert doctor, handles your material desires so that they don't increase, but actually they decrease. So that's expert management. Another skill of Krishna's is desire management. Krishna has no problem, of course, with his desires, but we have a problem with our desires. So Krishna, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead and Lord of the devotees, he helps the devotees to manage their desires. He doesn't just leave them to be railroaded and ravaged by their desires. When you sign up for the bhakti course, you're also asking Krishna's help in managing your desires. And he explains what his program is. That he, for the sincere devotee, if you have a material desire, he says, I'm not so unintelligent. I know what to do about the situation. I'll deal with that desire so that you get over it. That is, if you let Krishna do things his way, and if you follow his instructions, not that you just do whatever you like and then say, oh, Krishna will purify my material desires. You have to take the medical prescription. That's part of Krishna's process. Not that I'll do whatever I like, and then, and Krishna said he'll arrange that I never desire these things again, so I'll just do whatever. No. Bhakti is always, there's always two sides in bhakti, the Lord and the devotee. And of course, the spiritual master is representing the desires of the Lord. So therefore, we should never think we can carve out some kind of independent existence for ourselves in the name of spiritual advancement. We are dependent. We're always dependent upon the instructions and will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Rukmini's comment about mundane family life is very instructive. Who would want to leave your shelter, Krishna, and be attracted to some ordinary man. And she makes some wry comments about how impotent ordinary material men are. They're temporary bags of flesh decorated with mustaches and hair. What woman who has any intelligence would ever base her life on that? Of course, then you would say, well, is Rukmini implying that no one should get married? That's not the point, but she's saying that Krishna should be the center. We depend on Krishna, no matter what our ashram situation. We don't depend on limited, temporary relationships. We use those relationships, whatever they may be, mother, child, or husband, wife. We use those relationships as springboards to attain the eternal. So even though the relationships are temporary, you use them to achieve the eternal. That's yukta vairagya, that's mature spiritual life. Recognizing that everything is Krishna's property and using that everything to please Krishna. So even the temporary relationship between husband and wife can be used to achieve Krishna. And if the husband and wife are fully absorbed in devotional service in a sacrificial way, sacrificing to please Krishna's senses, there's no material contamination. The relationship becomes a conduit for devotional service and going back to Godhead. But that is the peak performance. And then there's also the lesser performance in which one becomes absorbed in mundane expressions of family life. Me and mine. This is the danger. Me and mine. My body, your body, and all the bodies in relationship to my body. The way to purify that misconception is by considering all living entities as your family. Because what does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? Krishna says, of all species of life, you should know I am the seed-giving father. That means everyone is our family. Why should we just pick out a few persons and say, of all the unlimited conditioned souls in the world, you pick out a few and limit your concern with them? That is mundane family life. But well, if you recognize that all living entities are your family, then indeed you can make spiritual advancement beyond the bodily conception of life. But why should we just consider the welfare of a few persons who happen to be in relation to our body? Why not see the whole world as family? Of course, this is no invitation for irresponsibility in terms of taking care of one's nuclear family. But it was just, we're speaking of the proper vision in seeing one's nuclear family as a unit for serving all living entities. That is the point. That's what the Shastra recommends. The husband, wife, and children, they are an ensemble. They are a unit for serving all living entities. Not just a few who you say, these are my relatives, so therefore I focus upon them. Mm-hmm. No. We want to be expansive servants of Lord Chaitanya and consider everyone as part of Krishna's family and act in such a way that we are increasing the welfare of all living entities. I was speaking in Mayapur about how a good portion of Christian theologians, priests, ministers, say that if it's true that there is life on other planets, that the Christian doctrine will have severe difficulties. Some persons I heard later thought that I was saying that, I was pronouncing that Christianity would have severe difficulties and it would come to an end. No, I was repeating what their own theologians were saying. Christianity is their affair, but I was just repeating what their own, I explained how the vast majority of Anglican bishops in the UK said, indeed, that point, that Christianity would have severe problems in doctrine if there is life on other planets. Because then you have to question, well, how do these persons fit in to Christ's crucifixion? Did he die on the cross for them? Or, if you're Jewish and you feel that you're the chosen people of God, well, what if these other people on another planet feel that they're the chosen people of God? So, these are issues that Christian theologians are grappling with, so I was just repeating that yeah, they say they're going to have some severe problems. Others, in the Catholic Church now, there are theologians who are grappling with this extraterrestrial issue, and they're already giving statements like, we would see all living entities, even extraterrestrials, as part of God's creation. Mm-hmm. Why the difficulty? It's easy to say all living entities are part of God's creation, but then you have to analyze how do they fit into religions that took their birth in the Near East and have a very earthly focus. Not even earth including all living entities, but human beings. Only human beings have souls. Animals don't have souls. Just a couple hundred years ago, only white human beings had souls. But now we things have progressed. All human beings have souls. That just happened in the past few hundred years. The Christian Church in the USA justified slavery in the southern part of the USA. You know, bucks drive the theology. Jerry Rogers' famous statement, bucks are the basis. So bucks are even the basis of theology. We want slaves. And so how do you go to church and consider yourself a good Christian and have slaves at the same time? Easy. The slaves have no souls. So just see, it's only in the past few hundred years that Christianity recognizes all human beings as having souls. Now, animals don't have souls. Plants don't have souls. Now, what are you going to do about extraterrestrials? They don't have souls either. So you see, there's a lot of difficulty. What does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? Pandita Savadarshana. The truly wise person sees all living entities as equal, knowing that they are spirit soul, wearing different coverings. So that's the basis of the kind of household life the Bhagavatam is recommending. A family unit is not meant to just focus in on itself, but focus out. It's a base for giving shelter, education, knowledge, and spiritual advancement to all living entities. That is the proper family life. Because then the instinct for selfishness is destroyed. The family unit, material family unit, has a tendency for selfishness. But if you follow the Vedic paradigm, there's so many measures and prescriptions to reduce that selfishness. Just like in the Srila Prabhupada would talk about how even in his childhood, in the very early 20th century, his father and mother would follow the Vedic injunction that before they took their meals, the man of the house would go out to the door and call up down the street, "Is anyone hungry? Is anyone hungry? Please come and eat." And then whoever came, they ate first, and then the family ate. Now, of course, that would be difficult to apply today. People would think you're crazy. You go to the door of your house and call up and down the street. People think you're mad. And only after the guests have eaten can you eat. And Srila Prabhupada said, and this was life in Calcutta in the early 20th century, that he said every night his father would have a few guests for dinner. And unfortunately, from Srila Prabhupada's point of view, he said, my father would invite whoever was wearing saffron or anyone who seemed to be a Babaji or a spiritual person. My father was very liberal, but Srila Prabhupada, as the son, could see, these are not genuine sadhus. These are just pretenders wearing saffron to get a free meal. But anyway, the point is that his father followed those social, Vedic social protocols, and that way the selfishness, the inherent self-centeredness of the family situation is reduced. The husband and wife see themselves as servants of others. They have an expansive view, not a locked-in view, ingrown view. So this is the ingenious intelligence behind the Vedic prescriptions for how even in family life one can rise above the bodily conception of life. So Rukmini is showing, number one, how to be the best wife, and number two, she's showing how to be a devotee, because Krishna is not only her husband, but Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and she is aware of that. You see, in this pastime of Rukmini Krishna, there are two things going on. Krishna, in talking to Rukmini and explaining why he teased her, he's putting down mundane affairs, mundane attachment, mundane family life. He's doing that as to give a lesson. But also there's something going on the internal platform, the internal potency, in which Krishna is showing how he relates to his consorts on the pure devotional platform where there's no material contamination. So he's giving lessons about the external energy while at the same time demonstrating the realities of the internal potency. So this is the wonder of Krishna Leela. So many things going on at